Okay, so the exam is tomorrow. It starts at 11, ends at 12:15. Those of you who have conflicts, two or three people, they can come and start 15 minutes earlier and then therefore stop exactly at 12. Okay, who are those people?
Three people.
Yeah, I got three emails. Yeah.
YBC 313.
Huh? I don't know. You also have that situation?
Yeah.
Who else is? And everybody who is in this situation is emailed at TC 313, correct? You are one more, so you also count the same. Homework number 5 went up there. It is now available for you. I'm sure you will only look at it after the exam, and that would be the right thing to do. Okay, so today we're going to talk about magnetic fields. This is when we take a step out of electrostatics and start talking about magnetostatics. Soon everything will become dynamic. For the time being, consider a pair of wires, two wires, side by side, and they are both carrying equal currents in the same direction, I. It is observed some time ago in early 1800s, they observed that two wires carrying currents in the same direction like this, side by side, tend to attract one another. They pull one another. Why? Well, we can explain this in terms of magnetic fields and Lorentz force. Let's attempt that, okay? This I, let's take the current in the first wire on the bottom and think that to be the source of the magnetic field that is generated in consistency with a certain right-hand rule that you may or may not remember from physics, but you will soon remember it. You point your thumb in the direction of the current that the wire is carrying. Your fingers are curling in the direction what turns out to be a magnetic field, okay? So then, at the location of the second wire, there is a magnetic field that's pointing out of the blackboard towards you that is due to the current of the first wire, okay? Now, this magnetic field over there just does the job of pulling the second wire towards the first wire if you invoke Lorentz law, force law. And how's that? The fact that the second wire is also carrying a current in that direction means that it can be thought of positive charges moving in that direction, or it can be negative charges moving in the other direction. Either way, it's going to work out. Let's think of the easier one, positive charge moving to the right. So then there is a lot of V's, positive charges that are moving to the right. Okay, so then I'm going to go Q, which is positive, times V cross B, and that I'm going to do using my right hand again. That is giving me a force that's pointing downwards, right? V cross B, downwards. There is a force that's pulling this. Any questions about this? Okay. If I had a negative charge, it would be going in the opposite direction, but its charge would also be negative. Two negatives would still make a force pointing in this direction. It doesn't matter whether the current is actually carried by positive or negative charge carrier. So here are two right-hand rules. Okay, I use one after the other. One is in the cross-multiplication. I use the right-hand rule that goes along with it. Second, my claim that the I in this direction is going to produce a B that is consistent with my right-hand rule, too. So the uses of right-hand rule multiplies, as I advertised earlier on. Any questions about this? So then what is this magnetic field that this current generates? Well, already we know that static charges generate electric fields. Evidently, perhaps, currents generate magnetic fields. And then one asks the question, are those magnetic fields related to electric fields? At the beginning, this was not very well known. But today, we know that absolutely, they are related to one another. Their aspects have been unified, first, in Maxwell's equations. But even more than that, with the advent of relativity, we can really now derive, once we know about relativity, we can derive all these magnetic fields and so forth from Coulomb's law, in some sense. Okay. Now, this relativity was something, the brainchild of Einstein, and he came up with relativity because he only well, trusted Maxwell's equation. He says that Maxwell's equation seemed to be right, and it should be applicable for all observers, stationary observers as well as moving observers in their own frame of reference. In their own reference frames of reference, those moving guys actually are stationary guys, okay? So it looks like Maxwell's equation should hold in all these frames, and he generalizes. He said all laws of physics should hold in all reference frames in the same form. They should have the same form. From this, he came into inconsistency with Newtonian dynamics. So he decided Maxwell's equations are right, but those common sense concepts that we borrow from Newtonian dynamics are not quite right. They have to be sort of like corrected. What are these things? These are the relationships between the coordinates measured in one frame of reference and coordinates measured in a moving frame of reference, okay? We relate them just by multiplying velocity times time. X prime is plus x plus or minus, depending in which direction, vt is the Galilean transformation that is based on common sense. Galileo and Newton used this to develop their dynamics. It seems to be just the right thing, common sense way. Well, Einstein said, hey, no, that's not quite right. That is because there is this real weird thing that Maxwell's equation says that speed of light is the same in everybody's reference frame, but there is only one light. If light has the same speed observed by every observer, then some of which are moving with respect to one another, then the addition of velocities, transformation of velocities from one reference to frame to the other reference frame cannot be a Galilean transformation. It's not so easy. And then new rules have to be come up. We need new rules. Those rules were sort of around. They are Lorentz transformations. Now, some of you have taken a course on this, and this is covered in University of Illinois in Physics 225 and Physics 325. Anybody here who have taken any of these courses? Okay, some of you have seen this. Others are not quite ignorant out of this, because this is out there in general culture. You know, Einstein was a phenomenon, right? I mean, everybody knows about Einstein, his crazy hair, his mustache, and everything he did. And we all read science fiction. Okay, from science fiction, you know that certain weird things are attributed to this relativity, and this is the twins paradox, the fact that two twins, one of them travels and comes back at very large speeds, and he's younger when he comes back, right? How many of you have read a science fiction book where this happened? Anybody who didn't read a book like this? The latest one, well, you should read one if that is the case. The latest one of this type was when my kids were growing up, Ender's Game. Any of you have read Ender's Game? Yeah, what happens? Ender travels a lot, his brother stays back at home, and then Ender is so much younger, right? So this is, it sounds like science fiction, but it is science. I mean, yes, it is science fiction, but it is also science. You take clocks and you move them around with large speeds, bring it back compared to the original clock that was kept in the lab, and the traveling clock is younger. It hasn't advanced as much. This is proven. Another one of these things is, and related to this time dilation, this is called time dilation. Twins paradox is based on time dilation. Moving clocks tick slower than stationary clocks. Okay, so this gives us time dilation. And apart from experiments that I have just suggested, there is one that is related to the generation of these muons in the upper atmosphere. You guys know about cosmic particles? These are real fast particles that are generated by some astronomic mechanism that are bombarding our atmosphere, okay? And when they come into our atmosphere, they create all sorts of high energy particles. One of them is a muon. What is a muon? Have you heard of a muon? Muon is just like an electron, but it's 200 times heavier. It's sort of a heavy electron. And because it's so heavy, it's unstable. It just goes away. It becomes an electron after a while. It decays into an electron, giving off some photons, okay? And the lifetime of these muons is tiny. It's about a microsecond. These muons are generated by cosmic particles at an altitude of maybe 30 kilometers or so. And then, where they're generated, then they come to Earth and hit it. How do they do this? How do they manage to do this if their lifetime is 1 microsecond? At 1 microsecond, you cannot travel 30 kilometers. Basically, if you are traveling with the speed of light, how much distance do you cover in 1 microsecond? 1 microsecond is 10 to the minus 6, and the speed of light is 3 times 10 to the 8. So 300 meters, 1 microsecond is 300 meters. So a muon that is born should cover 300 meters towards the Earth if it is traveling at the speed of light and then just disappear. How does it cover 30 kilometers? Well, it is related to this time dilation, okay? The clocks of the muon clicking very slow compared to us. Okay, we are measuring that distance in our frame of reference, 30 kilometers. So that is one way. From the point of view of the muon, something else happens, okay? Muon knows that after it's born, it's going to disappear within one microsecond. It says that I'm traveling towards that surface, which is Earth where we are living, okay? But muon, in his frame of reference, that 30 kilometer doesn't look like 30 kilometers. It looks much shorter, and this is called Lorentz contraction. Okay, those of you who have read these science fiction books probably have run into the Lorentz contraction either. To summarize, moving clocks take slower, and rulers that are moving appear shorter from reference frames in which they appear to be moving, okay? Of course, the rule itself in its own frame of reference has its length. Let's say it's 1 meter. That 1 meter stick, if it is moving in my reference frame, doesn't look like 1 meter. It looks a little bit shorter. This is Lorentz contraction, okay? In the muon's reference frame, that distance from Earth to the muon's altitude, 30 kilometers, doesn't look like 30 kilometers. It looks shorter. In fact, much shorter if the muon is moving with a velocity that is close to the speed of light. Okay, all those complexities stemming out from the relativistic dynamics that was sort of put together by Albert Einstein around 1905 is summarized in this footnote. This is a very long footnote, but if you have taken 225, it will make sense. If you haven't taken 225, it will probably not make sense, which means that you should take 225 whenever you have the opportunity. It's a good free elective or even a technical elective. Okay, it should be a required course, but it's not. So I try to motivate you to take this course. Just like you should take a little bit more quantum, you should take a little bit more relativity. So based on this Lorentz contraction, we can show how magnetic field arises from basically Coulomb attraction, and even derive a formula that will be of some use. So I'm going to now go through that derivation. So I'm going to consider a wire that is a single wire that is carrying current in my reference frame, which is the lab. This wire is sitting on the table, and it's carrying current. And that current is, if this is a copper wire, it is because negative charge carriers electrons are going in the direction opposite to the wire, opposite to the current that I'm measuring. Suppose that we are measuring a current that is in this direction, which is a positive current. And I know that this copper is charge neutral, okay? So it has a lot of pluses, which are stationary. Otherwise, this whole wire would be moving, right? It's the lattice of the wire that makes it either stationary or non-stationary in my reference frame. But there are also electrons. All these electrons are moving in this direction with a speed v. Okay? Because of that, there is in fact a current I. Okay? So now I can imagine the charge density of the positive charges to be equal in magnitude to the charge density of the negative charges, so that the entire wire is charge neutral. If the entire wire is charge neutral, then I can write something like this. Lambda is the charge density of the entire wire, which is the sum of lambda plus lambda minus, okay? Lambda plus is the charge density of the pluses, lambda minus is the charge density of minuses. I will assume that lambda minus, which has to be a negative number because it contains the charge density associated with electrons, which have negative charges, is equal to the negative of lambda plus. Therefore, this guy is equal to zero. If this guy is equal to zero, according to that famous formula, which is lambda divided by 2 pi epsilon naught r, that is the Coulomb field of an infinite line charge, is going to say there is zero electric field because lambda is equal to zero. So in the reference, in the lab frame, there is no electric field. This is an uncharged wire, okay? But I claim that in the reference frame of the electrons, that is not the case. This wire looks charged, okay? So let us now imagine looking into this wire from that perspective. Even better, let us assume that there is a charge Q, okay, that is moving in the same direction as the electrons with B, just outside the wire, okay? So some B, so we have a charge that is moving with B. That B can be used subsequently later on in Lorentz formula, Q times B cross B, that B, okay? But what is the B? So I'm going to now derive the B so that we get the full picture. Any questions here? So what makes the wire to be charge neutral in the reference frame is this relationship. However, when you look at the charge densities from the perspective of the frame of reference of the electrons, those electrons are moving in some direction, there is a Lorentz contraction related changes that are imposed both on the charge densities lambda plus and lambda minus. Okay? I don't want to go into the details of what happens exactly, but when you look at the charge densities of the electrons and the protons from the perspective of the frame of reference of the electrons, they are not exactly the same magnitude and opposite signs. There is a slight difference. Okay? It turns out that the charge density of the electrons in its own frame is slightly smaller in magnitude than the magnitude it has in the lab frame. And the charge density of the protons in the frame of reference of the electrons is slightly larger. Okay? Thus, when you add them up, you don't get zero results. So let us call lambda prime to be equal to lambda plus prime plus lambda minus prime. And these don't add up to zero like they did here, okay? They add into a tiny, tiny, tiny positive quantity, okay? And it works out. If you know about these Lorentz transformation equations, if you know about the details of Lorentz contraction and do the calculation, which I do in my notes in the footnotes, okay? Using the equation from the first page's footnote, you get the result to be this thing. Lambda plus from the lab reference frame multiplied by B square over C square is the tiny, tiny, tiny charge density that you have, okay? So there is a net non-zero charge density in the frame of reference of the electrons, which is a tiny fraction of the positive charge density of the protons in the lab frame. But the positive charge density of the protons in the lab frame was no good. It didn't give us any electric field because it was neutralized by the corresponding and negative charge density of the electrons. Therefore, there was no electric field produced in the lab frame. But in the electron frame, there is an electric field because there is a charge density. Any questions about this? This is really weird, but that's the way sort of things work out. And if there is a finite charge density, let me now know what I know to calculate the force that this charge is going to be experiencing. You have a question?
Yeah. So in this equation, this is the lambda in the reference frame.
So everything in prime is in the reference frame of the electrons.
But it equals out of the reference frame?
So it is also the sum of the electron and proton charge densities, okay? Just like here, in every reference frame, you have a charge density for the electrons and the protons. You sum them up, you get the total one. That total one ends up being zero in the lab frame, but in the other frame, it is non-zero because the lab frame charge densities of the electrons and the protons have transformed into the electron frame in different ways. One grew, one shrunk. Now, because of that, when you add them up, they don't cancel. The details are in those footnotes. I don't want to go through those details because for those of you who have never seen this result, me going through the details, it's going to put you to sleep. You will be confused. I don't want you to go through that. But if you have seen this topic before, I believe you can actually learn all the details quantitatively from the footnotes. Okay? All right. So, but important thing, John is the name, right? I have something multiplied with something super small. V over C squared is a very small number, simply because the homework that you are doing today shows you current carrying wires have electrons moving with tiny speeds. The speeds are tiny. Very small fraction of a speed of light. And when you take a small ratio and square, it becomes small square, super small. Okay? So there's almost no charge density. So there's going to be, but there is a world of a difference between no and some. Okay? Even small can be something that we have to pay attention to. Okay, so now I'm going to write down the electric field that this guy feels and then the force this guy feels. That electric field, if you wish, let's call it E prime, is going to be calculated using the R Coulomb's law derived equation. What was it? The charge density lambda divided by 2 pi epsilon naught in radial direction. So let's write that down. Now, for charge density, I'm going to go lambda plus V square over C square. And here I have 2 pi epsilon naught R. I'm measuring R in the radial direction perpendicular to the motion direction. Therefore, I don't need to make a distinction between R and R prime. You guys can see this. It is hard to see, but it's all in the notes, okay? So now, one more thing. This I, I can relate I to lambda plus. Think about it. Lambda plus is in coulombs per meter. If I were to multiply that with the speed v, the relative speed of the pluses and minuses, it would be coulombs per meter times meter per second. Meters would cancel out. I would get coulombs per second. That sounds like the right thing. Okay, so it is the right observation that the I here is nothing but lambda plus times v. V is the relative speed of the two species. Okay, so with that, I can start sort of transforming this equation as follows. Here I have lambda plus v times v. I can say lambda plus v is I, and then I'm left with v divided by c squared. Now, 1 over c squared has another way of writing. It is mu naught times epsilon naught. Mu naught times epsilon naught. That's just a fact of life that you see in physics. Okay? And mu is suddenly entering. There was no mu before in our world. It was only epsilon naughts. But suddenly mu is coming in because speed of light is here. And speed of light is related to mu. Okay? And then we have these guys, 2 pi epsilon naught r. But epsilon naught is now present in the numerator as well as denominator. It's the time for epsilon naught disappear from the picture, because that's the way things work out in the world of magnetostatics. There is no epsilon naught, but wherever you used to have epsilon naught, in its place you have 1 over mu naught, so to speak. That's what goes on. Okay, so now this is the electric field that the charge that is moving with speed v in the lab, which is actually stationary in this reference frame of the moving electrons, is seeing. It is seeing this stationary field. What is it going to do? It's going to feel a force. What is the force? It's this electric field times its own charge. So then if I multiply this guy with q, then I multiply this guy with q, then I have f prime. Okay? And we need some sort of a direction here, and it's the radially out direction. Okay, so now we have an equation for the force that this this moving charge is seeing in its own reference frame. Now that speed v of the electrons relative to ions for carrying the charge is a tiny velocity. That we know from our homework problem. Therefore, this distinction between prime and the reference, prime and the unprime reference frames is a very weak one. Okay? We can actually, apart from this one Lorentz contraction calculation, which gave us a tiny charge density, which we are keeping, we can ignore all the other distinctions, okay? I can say, hey, this F prime is, for all practical purposes, also is the F that I see on this charge, as seen from the lab frame. On the lab frame, I see this charge moving with velocity V, and I observe, actually, that there is a force on it, okay? And now I have a formula for that force that I didn't have before I gone through this distinction, this derivation. Okay, when I move back, I see nothing on this blackboard. I apologize for that. How can we help the situation? Is this helping it a little bit? Okay. In any case, all these things are in the notes. So when you look at the notes and remember what I'm saying, hopefully it's going to make sense. Now, I'm in a good situation because this equation can be sort of, I see that this is q times v cross b, basically. I see that there is q times v cross b. And why? Well, there is a q here, okay? And there is a v there. That's a scalar v, that is the relative speed of that electron, and also the charge itself. I can turn that into a vector, okay? And then there is I mu naught 2 pi r. So let me write that equation in a more familiar way. So the very same equation that I'm going to write, F is equal. Now this is the force that the moving charge in the lab with velocity V that is pointing to the left is experiencing, okay? It is going to be Q times vector velocity V crossed into what I will call B, okay? And the picture is here. Here's my wire. This is in the lab frame. Charge Q is moving in this direction with a velocity V. Now I am making that to be a velocity, okay? And I am going to assign this B a certain direction. What am I going to do? I'm going to assign that. I'm going to multiply I times mu naught divided by 2 pi r with a certain unit vector, such that when that unit vector and the V vector that I have are multiplied in the V cross into that unit vector, it is going to give me the force that is downwards. I am feeling a downwards force because I have a positive wire. That positive wire is pushing positive charges Q in the downwards direction. Do you see that? Okay, so now I have to define one more direction, and that direction I'm going to adopt by saying this. I'm going to put my right-hand thumb in the direction of the current, and my fingers are curling in a certain direction. That certain direction I'm going to call phi hat for the moment, okay? If you ask what is phi hat, the answer is the direction of my fingers, right-hand fingers, as they are curling when I put my right-hand thumb in the direction of the current. That is the definition of phi hat. Okay, and don't write this into your cheat sheet. That is too much to write into a cheat sheet, but it is something to learn and understand. Is that making sense, Jason? Okay, so now, I am going to say then this. This B here, evidently, is equal to everything else that's left in my formula. That is I times mu zero times I divided by 2 pi r, phi hat. That's my magnetic field. I'm done. Okay? So using statics, nothing but electrostatics, plus Einstein's idea that laws of physics are the same in all reference frames, which has implications for S contraction, I was able to get from Coulomb's law a formula that is part of Lorentz force law. Now we would add to this E times Q if also in the reference frame of the lab there was an electric field. We derived Lorentz formula. Okay? And we, not only we derived Lorentz formula, which shows up with a magnetic field in it, we also have an equation for the magnetic field of a current-carrying wire. Evidently, every infinite wire that carries a current creates a magnetic field in accordance with the right-hand rule. You just stick your thumb, right-hand thumb, in the direction of the current on that wire, and there is an encircling magnetic field lines. And there is a total azimuthal symmetry, okay? The blackboard was just one of the planes, but the 90-degree plane with respect to the blackboard, the physics is the same, okay? So there is one unique direction given by your right hand, and then this formula. This is the field of a magnetic field. This is the formula of a magnetic field that surrounds every wire. So every wire that is, now I can erase this. And, oh, before I erase this, this is correct, right? With the current going in this direction, and we have our phi, this is the magnetic field direction, okay? And V cross B gives us outward, downward force, okay? Are we now seeing where the right-hand rule came from? It's just the way, that's the way derivation showed it. Right-hand rule comes from Faraday's law. It comes from the formula for the electrostatic field of a line charge, with the line charge density that we used for a current-carrying wire because of Lorentz contraction. Okay? So now I can erase this and simply say I. So I pick for my current-carrying wire a current direction, then I have magnetic field lines that are surrounding, okay? So I have, now I have to draw a 3D perspective figure, which is always confusing, okay? If you look at it wrong, you get it wrong. But it is something like this, okay? If the picture confuses you, don't look at the picture, use your right hand and your brain. After all, you construct these images in 3D correctly in your brain, but not necessarily on a piece of paper. Okay, I'm happy with the picture. That is the B. And that B has an intensity. That intensity goes as 1 over R, okay? It blows up at R equal to 0. There is a singularity. That singularity is no surprise. There are such singularities for the static electric fields as well. And it goes weaker as you go far away. And R is, of course, the distance where you're evaluating the field. And then that's it. And it sort of looks like the Coulomb's law, in a sense. What is this? Not the 3D, but the 2D version of it. Any questions? That's it. Now we can take mileage out of this, okay? The mileage is going to be going from this particular result into what we call Ampere's law, okay? You see that this magnetic field is changing its direction, but not its strength as I go around, okay? And that magnetic field line is also closing upon itself, okay? Whereas E field started on positive charges and ended on negative charges, we found that magnetic fields, the fruit of our derivation, the child of our derivation, is closing upon itself. It doesn't close upon magnetic monopoles. There are no such things that have been observed. Okay, so why don't we just take the line integral following that magnetic field line, circular magnetic field line, and see what we conclude. Okay, so what if I write B dot dl, closing the circuit, and let me take my dl going in the same direction as the magnetic field, okay? And then when I finish this, this is going to evaluate to the, and this is parallel to B. So the dot product gives you the full length increment and the full magnetic field strength. So when you do that integral, you get nothing other than the strength of the magnetic field there multiplied by the circumference that you measure. What is that circumference? 2 pi? 2 pi r. Yeah, 2 pi r, that's beautiful because there is also 2 pi r here in the bottom. When I do this integration, the 2 pi r that is coming from the circumference cancels the 2 pi r that is in the formula for b in the bottom. And what is the overall result? What is that integral? Somebody say. Mu naught times I, exactly. So we get mu naught times I. Simply because I considered this, okay? And simply because my DLs were also in the phi direction. Now, this is a singular result. This is true only for the magnetic field structure that surrounds an infinite wire. Now, you start distorting and through a circular path. Now, you start distorting that path and scratch your head and do a little bit thinking and a little bit of math, and you decide that I don't care how I distort that path. As long as my path of integration is closed, I am always going to get the same result. Correct? Does everybody see that? And that is similar to the argument that we had with the Gauss's law. In the Gauss's law, we enclose our charge at the center of a sphere, got the result that the flux over that sphere equals the charge enclosed, divided by epsilon naught, and then we say, however we distort our surface from a spherical shape into other shapes, it doesn't matter. As long as I count all the charges inside the surface, I'm good. So this is the same thing. If you do a line integral of magnetic field, B dot del, over a closed circuit of an arbitrary shape, okay, you are always going to get mu naught times I, but this time I is the total current that is piercing that particular surface. Once I have my C, okay, and I take a direction to encirculate that, then I put my right thumb in the direction of that circulation, and then I pay attention to where my fingers are going through, okay? That direction is the direction of the currents that I should be counting, okay? So whenever I do a B dot dl integration over a closed contour C, it is always equal to mu naught times total current, the current defined as the current crossing from one side to the other side, but in the direction of your fingers crossing that area. Okay? With every C, there is a corresponding area. Okay, there is a corresponding surface area. And that surface area can be simple or more complicated. If this contour is on this plane of the blackboard, you can select a flat area that I have cross-hatched, okay? But also we can take a bombed out or concave or convex surface area. It doesn't matter. That surface area doesn't exactly matter, okay? Independent of that, all I have to do is count the total current that is going through the surface area. Now, if I have a total current crossing a certain surface area, I can also imagine, instead of total current, J, which is current density, as it is spread out over that surface area, and then refer to the total current I as the surface integral over the, over that surface of the current density, correct? All right, so now I am just about to write this equation in a slightly different form based on that idea. So I erase all this relativity stuff. You've seen it. Purcell's textbook is a beautiful textbook dating from the 60s in which this type of a derivation is given. Feynman book also gives this type of a derivation of the magnetic field, how it is derived from electrostatics. So there is a quite a bit of reading you can do. And in my footnotes, I make references to individual papers which are nice to read. So let me just now write that equation in a slightly different form. The line integral of B dot dl. And I'm going to put that mu naught on this side, and I'm going to write now the current in a slightly different fashion. And it is going to, and this is for across a contour. And that contour is bounding a surface area S, and I'm going to say that J dot ds over the S, this is Ampere's law. That is pertinent for electrostatics. In electrostatics, magnetostatic. In magnetostatics, static current generates static magnetic fields, and the magnetic field, whatever is the shape of the current distribution, is always going to be consistent with this rule. If the current shape is complicated, you have a complicated problem to solve. We started with something very easy and enlarged upon this. That plus superposition gave us a legitimate reason to write this more complicated constraint. This more complicated constraint applies to simple cases as well as complicated cases, but there is a lot of math that is needed in complicated cases. Now, this B divided by mu naught, I can erase and call it H. Okay, so H is B divided by mu naught. And in free space, this is just a scaling. In material media, we will revise this relationship just like we revise D is equal to epsilon E relationship, but that's for another day. This is Ampere's law. Now, there is one more thing I can say. Stokes' theorem. Stokes' theorem relates the line integral, closed line integral of vector quantities to the surface integrals of their curves. Like divergence theorem relates flux integrals to volume integrals of divergences. Okay, so let me remind what Stokes' theorem says this is equivalent to. Okay, according to Stokes' theorem, which you learn in Math 241 and immediately forgot, and now I am torturing you by reminding it, is the following. See this contour? This contour is bounding some surface area, S. Okay, I can always say that this is equal to the surface area integral over surface S of the vector, which is the curl of H, dotted into ds. What is ds? Ds is the area element that is subdividing surface S into pieces. Okay? So that I can do a surface area integration. What is the dot? It is the dot product. And what is ds? Vectorially, ds is vectorially consistent with my right-hand rule. The right-hand rule that says that once you pick your circulation direction, always take for ds the vector that is pointing across the surface, normal to the surface, but in the direction where your fingers are, right-hand fingers are pointing, not the other way around. Okay? So now, I have a surface integral on the right left-hand side. I have a surface integral right-hand side. For those two surface integrals to be equal to one another, what should I have? What should I need for curl of H? Check, exactly. Because this guy and this guy are the same animals. They are equal to one another. They can only be equal to one another if curl of H is equal to J. So, curl of H is equal to J. So this is the differential form of Ampere's law. This is the integral form of Ampere's law. We may need both of them. In certain problems, it is easier to use the differential form. In certain other problems, it's easier to use the integral form. Okay? And we will have some examples illustrating these things. Any questions? So, all this stuff was in my notes. So we went all through these derivations. You can read the details of Lorentz construction and all that. And now you see a wire that is carrying a current, and the right hand will dictate the magnetic field line surrounding it. I go around one of them, pick up the fact that the line integral around one equals mu naught times I. Then I superpose all such things, and I reach this equation, where H is defined like this. Okay, it's all here on the blackboard. And then I say my included current is nothing other J dot ds. J dot ds is a current. J is a current density. J dot ds is a current. I use Stokes' theorem and reduce the integral form equation into the differential equation, differential form, curl of H is equal to J. Ah, one more thing. We have this B formula for the B of a single wire, okay? All other Bs can be sort of like generated from that formula through superpositions. And you can easily show that the curl, that the divergence of that field is equal to zero. Therefore, all divergences also go to zero. So now we have the full equations of magnetostatics. There you go. Okay. If you are given the J, static J, throughout a volume, then you can always find a magnetic field, B, that satisfies both of those equations. And that's, there's a unique solution, and that solution is what you strive for. Okay. And this is sort of like a little bit similar to, but a little bit asymmetric with respect to the electrostatics equation. In electrostatic equation, we have the curl of the electric field is equal to zero, and the source was coming from the divergence. Divergence of D was equal to rho. And how did we solve that problem in the most general sense? We said, oh, the curl of E being equal to zero means E is the negative gradient of a potential V. We substituted that into the Gauss's law. That gave us a Poisson's equation. And that Poisson's equation is what we solve. Most of the time, it is Laplace equation form. And Laplace equation form says, hey, you know, if it's a one-dimensional problem, you have a linear B, etc. That's how we solve this problem. We are going to do something similar, but it's not going to be the same. Because the curl of H is not equal to zero, there is not a scalar potential whose gradient matches our magnetic field. Rather, the divergence of B is equal to zero. Therefore, there is a vector potential, A, that can do the job. This is what we're going to look at the lecture after the exam. But right now, we can do something easier. We can simply look at... we can go to the next lecture and use the integral form of Ampere's law and a little bit of symmetry to get some easy results. The easy results are going to be the magnetic field due to a current sheet. That is my example number one. Okay, then we will have the magnetic field produced by a slab of current. That's going to be my example number two. Then I will take an infinite current sheet and wrap it around and turn it into a solenoid. And then we will see that magnetic field only occupies the interior part of the solenoid, no magnetic field outside, and that's an important structure. Okay, so a few important structures like this will pave the road to us to make progress. For closure purposes, I want to point out something. When many, many days ago, I was deriving the field of the line, infinite line. You might have said, hey, so what? This is a boring thing. He's just doing it because it's easy to do. Well, that was partially true. But another reason why I did that is because it enabled today. Today, my derivation of magnetic field was hinging on that, okay? So each of these results that you get, some of them are idealized results, fills you with a repertoire that makes you to deduce other things later down the line, okay? So finding the field of a current sheet or the field of a solenoid is important in that sense. And then also the field of a single loop current, which is complicated math, actually. We will do some of this. Okay, let's look at this one. I imagine now a current sheet, a J, okay? A current sheet, what is the units of a current sheet? Current, volumetric current is J, amperes per meter squared. So current sheet, J sub S is amperes per meter. Okay, furthermore, so I imagine a Z-directed current sheet here, okay? Located at X equal to zero surface. Furthermore, I can imagine that surface, if you will, nothing other than very closely spaced individual wires carrying some currents, and then a macroscopic view of that is perhaps the current sheet. Either way, these two pictures are useful in some sense or another. Okay, if I look at the single wire, if I pick one of those wires, I know in which direction the magnetic field it produces is going to be. It's going to obey a right-hand rule. I stick my finger, thumb, in the direction of that and go like this, okay? So it's gonna create a magnetic field that's going in this direction and on the opposite side in the other direction. Now, of course, it's not, but that magnetic field just circulates around. But all those other components in circulation are gonna cancel when I consider the total, all of them, okay? So whatever field, magnetic field I have going in that direction due to this wire is going to be canceled due to another wire, okay? So all components are going to go away, die away, except for providing me an overall magnetic field that is evidently pointing in y direction on one side of the sheet and minus y direction on the other side of the sheet. So far, I have used my right-hand rule and result that I remember from a single wire to orient myself to discover some sort of a symmetry in this problem. I can see, based on that, the result that I'm going to have for the magnetic field, was only I have to find a B sub y function, and B sub y as a function of x is going to be a, is it going to be an even function or an odd function? Even or odd? Somebody, I hear odds. It's going to be odd, because the sign flips, okay? B sub y is positive in x greater than 0 and negative. All right, so this is very similar in many ways to the surface charge problem that we had, but instead of using a Gaussian pillbox, we're going to use an Amperian, if you will, integration path, rectangular integration path. So here we go. Okay, so we will construct in our minds a certain closed path over which we will do the integral form of Ampere's law. Okay, we will calculate the circulation in this direction, and then say that that circulation of H, if you will, or B divided by mu naught, is equal to the total current that is piercing. And in which direction? Well, I put my thumb in the circulation direction. My fingers indicate that I need the total current piercing in the direction in plus C direction. And that total current is going to be the current density multiplied by this length L, because there is no current anywhere else other than on that surface. So here we go then. Here is the entire derivation. So I tried to implement this through algebra, nothing other than that. I have a B of X multiplying L, that is this contribution. And that is pointing in Y direction. I did not jot that down, but you keep that in mind. Okay, and then the two edges of that rectangle contribute nothing, because there the magnetic field is perpendicular to the edge direction. And then finally, there is a contribution that is coming from the other side. Okay, and then there is a minus sign there, because the field in the y direction is opposite to the dl, and because of that, there is a minus sign. However, the odd symmetry is going to say the negative B of minus X is equal to positive B of X. And because of that, when I evaluate this equation, I'm going to get a B of X that gives us this result. So there is a doubling up, okay? So you can erase this, double this, cancel else. The result is B naught is equal, B is equal to mu naught JS divided by 2. And it doesn't depend. It really doesn't depend at what distance. X didn't come into the picture here. So it is independent of position, just like the field of the field of a surface charge in electrostatic was independent of the distance from that surface, okay? I see that some of you are just falling asleep, okay? Just wake up, because in homework you'll be doing similar sorts of stuff, okay? So then B is mu naught JS divided by 2. Let me pull mu downstairs, B over mu naught, that I call it H. Then H is simply JS over 2. This is very similar to the D being rho S over 2. Okay? And they were pointing in opposite direction, and here too they are pointing in opposite direction. And in this case, the right hand rules. Okay? So every time I give you a magnetic problem, you instinctively should go with your right hand. Point it in the direction of the current and see where your fingers are curling. That's always going to be involved in the answer. Okay? More important than any of the individual details of the equation is the right hand rule. But then this result, half the current density becomes H, is significant. Now, what is the units of H? It should be current density, since this is what we are coming up with. It should be current density, yes. And which is amperes per meter, yes. And what is the magnetic field unit?
Tesla.
Teslas, or Weber per meter squared. So let me stop here.